more senior correspondents had departed, often unceremoniously. These were guys who had given their lives to a profession that could be lavishly kind or capriciously cruel. I'd seen so many careers soar or sour based on seemingly random things, such as changing physical appearance, the personal whim of a specific anchor or executive, or the emergence of a more eye-catching rival. In discussing the unpredictability of my profession with my brother recently, he told me about scientific studies where lab rats were rewarded with food pellets at random, illogical times. Those rats went crazy. To make matters worse, the country was in the most severe recession since the Great Depression. Bear Stearns had just collapsed, along with Lehman Brothers. The stock market was in free fall. It felt like the world had gone off a cliff no one had seen coming. ABC News went through a wrenching round of layoffs. While my job seemed safe at the moment, I felt bad for my colleagues and fretted about the future. When I thought about alternative careers, I drew a blank. What other marketable skills did I have besides wearing makeup and bellowing into cameras? This was a bit maudlin, but there were a few times when I found myself lying on the couch in my office, staring at a picture on my wall of the ocean, thinking about the word impermanence. On one such occasion, there was a knock on my door. It was David Muir popping by to chat. We had a lot in common. We'd both worked in local news in Boston, arrived at the network before the age of 30, and loved to travel the planet doing stories. Just a couple of months earlier, David had filed some amazing reports from Chernobyl. He had the office down the hall from me, and we'd sometimes get together to talk about our latest stories or just gossip. In the spirit of misery looking for company, I asked him what he would do if the whole TV news business imploded. He shrugged his shoulders with enviable insouciance and said, I'd find something else. Back in the toilet on the airplane coming home from Brazil, I replayed that scene in my mind as I continued to stare at my faltering hairline. Easy for you to say, Muir, with your full head of hair. I'd been in this position in front of the mirror for at least 10 minutes. I realized, with a twinge of embarrassment, that there was probably a line outside by now. I let my hair fall back down onto my forehead and returned, sheepishly, to my seat. About a month or so later, on a sunny Saturday in September, I was at a block party in New Jersey. There was a cookout, a bounce castle for the kids, and a band with a bassist wearing a do-rag. When the music stopped, a pastor took the mic and declared, with his voice echoing off the brightly colored vinyl siding of the surrounding row houses, "There's room for everyone at the cross today." I was here for a story about Sarah Palin, recently plucked from obscurity to become John McCain's running mate. A video had just hit the web showing Palin praying for God's help to get a gas pipeline built in her home state of Alaska. That had sparked a lot of discussion about the fact that she was a Pentecostal, a strain of Christianity sometimes described as evangelicalism on steroids. I wanted to do a piece that would explain to viewers exactly what Pentecostals believed. The closest church was here in Jersey City, and they just happened to be throwing a party. To be away from the noise, our cameraman, soundman, and producer had set up for the interviews a little farther down the street. The three of them were in the middle of an animated discussion led by Felicia, the producer, a petite, apple-cheeked mother of two with whom I'd worked for many years. She was telling the others about a book she'd just read by someone named Eckhart Tolle. As I approached, she turned toward me. "Have you read him? You might like him. It's all about controlling your ego." The crew burst out laughing. Like me, they took it as a joke about the anchorman's inevitably inflated sense of self-importance. Felicia, earnest and unfailingly polite, flushed and, speaking rapidly now, assured us that she wasn't making a joke. Her point was that she had read Tolle's books and found them personally useful. More than that, Oprah had been heavily promoting his latest volume, and she thought Tolle might make a good story. Fair enough. I was always looking for stories, and this one, featuring an Oprah-approved self-help swami, sounded like it might include the requisite exotica. So when I got home later that day, I went online and ordered the book. By the time his book arrived at my apartment a few days later, I'd almost forgotten about Eckhart Tolle. I saw the cheesy orange cover shining dully through Amazon's irrationally excessive bubble wrap. It bore the rather overwrought title, "A New Earth Awakening to Your Life's Purpose," as well as the seal of Oprah's book club. I propped it on my chest that night, and unsuspecting Bianca sleeping to my left, blissfully unaware that her future husband was being sucked into a strange vortex. At first, the book struck me as irredeemable poppycock. I was put off by the strained stateliness of Tolley's writing, as well as its nearly indecipherable turgidity. How could Oprah fans stand to drink from a fire hose of jargon like conditioned mind structures and the one indwelling consciousness? What's more, the guy was stunningly grandiose. He referred to his book as a transformational device and promised that as you read, a shift takes place within you. I lay there, rolling my eyes, quietly cursing Felicia for inflicting this upon me. But just when I thought I'd been defeated by all the porridge about inner opening and the impending shift in planetary consciousness, a clearing appeared in the spiritual thicket. Tolley began to unfurl a fascinating thesis, one that made me think he must have somehow spent an enormous amount of time inside my skull. Our entire lives, he argued, are governed by a voice in our heads. This voice is engaged in a ceaseless stream of thinking, most of it negative, repetitive, and self-referential. It squawks away at us from the minute we open our eyes in the morning until the minute we fall asleep at night, if it allows us to sleep at all. Talk, talk, talk. This voice is constantly judging and labeling everything in its field of vision. Its targets aren't just external. It often viciously taunts us, too. Apparently, Felicia was right when she got all flustered on that little street in Jersey City. Tolley wasn't using the term ego the way most of us normally do. He wasn't referring simply to pride, conceit, or amour propre of the variety often displayed by people who appear on television for a living. Nor was he using it in the Freudian sense as the psychological mechanism that mediates between our id and our superego, our desires and our morality. He meant something much larger. According to Tolley, the ego is our inner narrator, our sense of I. Certainly, Tolley had described my mind to a T. While I'd never really thought about it before, I suppose I'd always assumed that the voice in my head was me, my ghostly internal anchorman hosting the coverage of my life, engaged in an unsolicited stream of insensitive questions and obnoxious color commentary. Per Tolley, even though the voice is the ridgepole of our interior lives, most of us take it completely for granted. He argued that the failure to recognize thoughts for what they are, quantum bursts of psychic energy that exist solely in your head, is the primordial human error. When we are unaware of the egoic mind, egoic being a word he appears to have invented, we blindly act out our thoughts, and often the results are not pretty. I began to recall some of the many brilliant suggestions the voice in my head had made to me over the years. You should do cocaine. You're right to be angry at that producer. Throw your papers in the air. That Pakistani protester is way out of line. Even though he's surrounded by 1,000 angry friends, you should have a shouting match with him. I'd been reading for an hour now and totally had my full attention. As I turned the pages, he began to list some of the ego's signature moves, many of which seemed to be grabbed directly from my behavioral repertoire. The ego is never satisfied. No matter how much stuff we buy, no matter how many arguments we win or delicious meals we consume, the ego never feels complete. Did this not describe my bottomless appetite for airtime or drugs? Is this what my friend Simon meant when he said I had the soul of a junkie? The ego is constantly comparing itself to others. It has us measuring our self-worth against the looks, wealth, and social status of everyone else. Did this not explain some of my worrying at work? The ego thrives on drama. It keeps our old resentments and grievances alive through compulsive thought. Is this why I would sometimes come home to Bianca scowling over some issue at the office? Perhaps the most powerful Tollian insight into the ego was that it is obsessed with the past and the future at the expense of the present. We live almost exclusively through memory and anticipation, he wrote. We wax nostalgic for prior events during which we were doubtless ruminating or projecting. We cast forward to future events during which we will certainly be fantasizing. But as Tolley pointed out, it is quite literally always now. We like to capitalize that word. The present moment is all we've got. We experienced everything in our past through the present moment, and we will experience everything in the future the same way. I was a pro, I realized, at avoiding the present, a ringer. This had been true my whole life. My mom always described me as an impatient kid rushing through everything. In eighth grade, an ex-girlfriend told me, when you have one foot in the future and the other in the past, you piss on the present. Now, as a grown-up in the deadline-dominated world of news, I was always hurtling headlong through the day, checking things off my to-do list, constantly picturing completion instead of calmly and carefully enjoying the process. The unspoken assumption behind most of my forward momentum was that whatever was coming next would definitely be better. Only when I reached that ineffable whatever would I be totally satisfied. Some of the only times I could recall being fully present were when I was in a war zone or on drugs. No wonder one begat the other. It finally hit me that I'd been sleepwalking through much of my life, swept along on a tide of automatic, habitual behavior. All of the things I was most ashamed of in recent years could be explained through the ego, chasing the thrill of war without contemplating the consequences, replacing the combat high with coke and ecstasy, reflexively and unfairly judging people of faith, getting carried away with anxiety about work, neglecting Bianca to tryst with my BlackBerry, obsessing about my stupid hair. It was a little embarrassing to be reading a self-help writer and thinking, this guy gets me. But it was in this moment, lying in bed late at night, that I first realized that the voice in my head, the running commentary that had dominated my field of consciousness since I could remember, was kind of an asshole. This is where things got confusing, though. Just as I was coming to the conclusion that Tolly was a sage who perhaps held the key to all of my problems, he started saying some ludicrous shit. It was no longer his rococo writing style that was throwing me. I was getting used to that. No, now what was sticking in my craw was his penchant for making wild, pseudoscientific claims. He argued that living in the present moment slowed down the aging process and made the molecular structure of the body less dense. He asserted that thoughts have their own range of frequencies, with negative thoughts at the lower end of the scale and positive thoughts at the higher. Sometimes, in the course of a single sentence, he would say something lucid and compelling and then veer straight into crazy town. I honestly could not figure out if he was a genius or a lunatic. Then I learned more about who this guy actually was. After several nights of reading his book well into the wee hours, I padded over to the computer to do a little Googling. I don't know what I was expecting, but certainly not this, a small, sandy-haired German man who appeared to be at some indeterminate point north of middle age. His presentation style was totally at odds with the voice of God tone he affected on the page. In YouTube videos, he spoke softly and slowly, excruciatingly so, as if someone had forced him to ingest a large dose of my leftover Klonopin. His wardrobe appeared to consist solely of sweater vests and pleated khakis. One observer described him as looking like a communist-era librarian. Another called him a pale, kindly otter. The seminal event of his personal history was an experience he claimed to have had as a severely depressed graduate student at Oxford University. He said he was lying in his bed when he was overcome with suicidal thoughts. Suddenly, he felt himself being sucked into a void. He heard a voice telling him to resist nothing. Then everything went dark. He woke up the next morning, and the birds were chirping, the sunlight was a revelation, and his life was a shiny, sparkly thing. It was, quite literally, an overnight panacea. Bingo, done, sorted. After that is when he spent 2 years living on park benches in a state of the most intense joy. This was his spiritual awakening, of which he would later say, "The realization of peace is so deep that even if I met the Buddha and the Buddha said, 'You are wrong,' I would say, 'Oh, isn't that interesting? Even the Buddha can be wrong.'" Eventually, he moved to Canada, which had the right energy field for his first book to be born. That book, The Power of Now, became a celebrity sensation. Meg Ryan gave it to Oprah, who put copies on the nightstands in the guest rooms of all of her homes. Jim Carrey and Jenny McCarthy produced videotaped testimonials before they broke up. Paris Hilton carried the book through a gauntlet of paparazzi on her way into jail over a driving violation. When his follow-up, A New Earth, came out, Oprah put on an unprecedented 11-part webinar. Millions of people tuned in to watch her and Tolley sit at a desk deconstructing the book chapter by chapter. Their personal styles were almost comically mismatched. Oprah would whoop and holler as Tolley looked on placidly. Tolley would prattle on about energy fields as Oprah mmmed and ahed credulously. At one point, she threw up her arms for a double high five, and Tolley, clearly not knowing what such a thing was, awkwardly clasped her hands. Sitting there in my underwear in front of my computer in the middle of the night, I put my head in my hands. My whole life, I'd prided myself on being a skeptic. I'd spent nearly a decade interviewing spiritual leaders, and none of them penetrated my defenses. Now, this guy, who looked like a character from The Hobbit, was the one who had punched through? I was looking in the mirror again, this time at an angry red hole the size of a quarter, smack in the middle of my right cheek. When the dermatologist first discovered the milky patch on my cheek, basal cell carcinoma, a non-lethal form of skin cancer, I was tempted to just leave it there. Face surgery was an unappetizing prospect for a guy who went on TV for a living. The doctor, however, along with Bianca, argued that inaction was not an option. If I let it spread unchecked, they told me, it could get into my eye socket and blind me. For a nanosecond, I considered whether I might prefer partial blindness to a scar, even though the doctor promised that if everything went well, said scar would be a small one. The surgery was Chinese water torture. The surgeon, a crisp young woman, made an initial incision using a microscopically guided scalpel to remove the cancer. After that first stab, she sent me out to the waiting room as she ran some tests to see if she'd gotten it all. I joined Bianca at a bank of chairs where I pulled out my copy of A New Earth, which I was now reading for the third time. After a half hour or so, the doctor called me back and said they needed to dig a little deeper. So I went under the knife again and then back to the waiting room where I read more of the book. Another half hour passed and then the nurse came back and told me they still hadn't gotten every last teeny bit. They'd need to take a wider slice. When I arrived back in the procedure room this time, the doctor explained that the cancer was bigger than she had thought and she still didn't know how big. I pressed her for worst case scenarios and she admitted that there was a danger that it might have spread into the lower part of my eyelid. If that were true, closing the wound would involve a scar that permanently pulled down my right eye. I could feel my heartbeat accelerate as the following movie instantly played out in my mind. Scar, the size of Omar Little's from The Wire, fired from ABC News, seeks career in radio. But then a funny thing happened. After all my reading about the empty nattering of the ego, I realized these fearful forecasts were just thoughts skittering through my head. They weren't irrational, but they weren't necessarily true. It was a momentary glimpse of the wisdom of Tolley's thesis. It's not like I'd never been aware of my thoughts before. I'd had plenty of experience with being scared and knowing I was scared. What made this different was that I was able to see my thoughts for what they were, just thoughts with no concrete reality. It's not that my worry suddenly ceased, I just wasn't as taken in by it. I recognized the truth of this situation. I had no idea what was going to happen to my face, and reflexively believing the worst-case scenarios coughed up by my ego certainly wasn't going to help. The doctor made her third slice and sent me back into the waiting room. Bianca remarked that I was staying surprisingly calm. I didn't want to give the credit to Tolley, lest she think I was going crazy. She already thought it was weird that I'd been reading this book for so long. Ultimately, I had to go back in for four facial slices before the tumor was fully removed. They came within a millimeter, but the lower part of my eyelid was spared. Before they sewed me up, the doctor showed me the wound in a mirror, and I nearly fainted. I could see well into the side of my cheek, blood, fat, and all. Bianca took out her phone and snapped a picture. I had done surprisingly well in the crucible of face surgery, but you can't carry an Eckhart Tolle book around with you everywhere you go. A couple of weeks later, I was checking TV Newser, an addictive website that tracks the doings of the broadcast news industry, and I came across a list of the anchors and correspondents who would be covering the inauguration of President Barack Obama. My name was not mentioned. I was, to put it mildly, displeased. Unlike my experience with the surgery, here I was unable to achieve any distance from the angry thoughts caroming through my head. Instead, I took the bait dangled by my ego, which was yammering on in high dudgeon, "You're getting screwed here, dude." I shoved back my chair and started pacing around my office in tight circles like a chihuahua doing dressage. Over the next 24 hours, I buttonholed every executive I could find and voiced my complaints. Instead of winning me a role in the coverage, however, this whining earned me a reprimand. One of my bosses took me aside and told me that the decision wasn't personal, and then advised me to stop bleeding all over the place. This was my major beef with Tolley. Setting aside my qualms about his flowery writing, questionable claims, and bizarre backstory, what I truly could not abide was the lack of practical advice for handling situations like this. He delivered an extraordinary diagnosis of the human condition with basically no action plan for combating the ego, never mind for achieving living on a park bench super bliss. How do we do a better job of staying in the now? Tolley's answer? Always say yes to the present moment. How do we achieve liberation from the voice in the head? His advice? Simply be aware of it. To become free of the ego is not really a big job, but a very small one. Yes, right, easy. But if it were this uncomplicated, wouldn't there be millions of awakened people walking around? Then there was an even larger question. Even if I had been able to recognize that my umbrage over not being included in inauguration coverage consisted of mere thoughts, should I have simply ignored them? I could see the value of recognizing thoughts for what they are, fleeting, gossamer, unsubstantial. But aren't some thoughts connected to concrete realities that need to be addressed? In his books, Tolley repeatedly denigrated the habit of worrying, which he characterized as a useless process of projecting fearfully into an imaginary future. There is no way you can cope with such a situation because it doesn't exist. It's a mental phantom, he wrote. But while I understood the benefit of being in the now, the future was coming. Didn't I have to prepare? If I didn't think through every permutation of every potential problem, how the hell would I survive in a competitive industry? Furthermore, wasn't the restless ego the source of mankind's proudest achievements? Sure, it was probably responsible for ills such as war, child abuse, and Pauly Shore movies, but hadn't human striving also given us the polio vaccine, Caravaggio's paintings, and the iPhone? And yet, I was aware, of course, that my chattering mind was not entirely working in my favor. I was pretty sure that staring at my hairline or brooding on my couch was not time well spent. I used to think pressing the bruise kept me on my toes. Now I realize those moments mostly just made me unhappy. Tolley was forcing me to confront the fact that the thing I'd always thought was my greatest asset, my internal cattle prod, was also perhaps my greatest liability. I was now genuinely questioning my own personal orthodoxy, my price of security mantra, which had been my operating thesis since like age 8. All of a sudden, I didn't know, was it propulsive or corrosive? I wanted to excel, yes, but I also wanted to be less stressed in the process. This strange little German man seemed to raise the tantalizing possibility of doing both, but the books were not at all explicit about how to do so, at least not in a way that I understood. So I decided I needed to meet this guy. I ran into Felicia in the hallway at work. "Let's book Eckhart Tolley for an interview," I said. "We could do it as a Sunday profile," a weekly feature we'd recently decided to launch. It was as if I'd told her that she'd hit the Powerball or been chosen for beatification. She was beaming. Unlike me, she did not harbor suspicions that Tolley might be a fruitcake. She was all in. A couple of days later, she reported back that Tolley, who apparently rarely granted interviews, had said yes. He'd be in Toronto in a few weeks giving a sold-out speech, and we'd been granted a one-hour audience. They're being really strict about the time limit, she said, but she was still giddy. I flew in from New York on the morning of the interview. When I arrived at the hotel room where we'd be shooting, Felicia was there with the camera crew and a clean-cut young Australian guy named Anthony, who appeared to be Tolley's right-hand man. I'd expected a larger staff, but it was just this one guy. As we awaited the arrival of the great man, Anthony told me his story. He'd read some of Tolley's books, called him up, and asked for a job. When Tolley said yes, Anthony packed all his stuff and moved from Australia to Vancouver, where Tolley lived. Anthony struck me as reasonably normal with his neatly gelled blonde hair and pressed shirt. He discussed his boss with genuine admiration, but not adulation. Nothing in his bearing screamed cult to me. Shortly thereafter, there was a knock on the door, and Tolley entered. The first thing I noticed was that he was small, smaller than me, and I'm about 5'8" on days when I've used Bianca's volumizing shampoo. No entourage, just him. He had none of the swagger of a man who'd sold tens of millions of books and had a one-man industry of speaking gigs, CDs, and inspiration cards. He walked up and introduced himself with a handshake. He was unassuming, but not shy. Not unfriendly, but not especially warm. Just as he had on Oprah's webinar, he seemed pleased to be there, but not particularly eager. He was wearing an astoundingly bland brown blazer over a tan sweater and a pale blue dress shirt. He had a scraggly beard that covered just his chin and neck. After the exchange of pleasantries, we took our seats for the interview. There were two cameras, one trained on Tolley, the other on me. I was mildly self-conscious about my mottled cheek, but mostly I was just excited. Here I was, finally face-to-face with the man who had come out of nowhere and so thoroughly intrigued and confused me. This was the first interview since I'd started covering spirituality where I actually felt like I had some skin in the game. "How on earth do you stop thinking?" I began. "How do you stop the voice in your head?" I had a momentary surge of optimism as he shifted in his chair in clear preparation to give the practical advice I'd been yearning for. "You create little spaces in your daily life where you are aware but not thinking," he said. "For example, you take one conscious breath." "Unbreak my heart, Eckhart. That's all you've got?" "But," I said, "I can hear the cynics in the audience saying, 'This guy's saying I can awaken by taking a deep breath. What's he talking about?'" "Yes, that's the mind talking. Of course, many people will have their mind commenting on what I'm saying and saying that is useless." In fact, that was exactly what my mind was saying. That is useless. My mind started saying things that were even less charitable as he rolled out his second allegedly practical suggestion. "Another very powerful thing to do is to become aware of the inner energy field of your being." Aware that I had a camera aimed at me, I hammed it up, again using that old journalistic trick of channeling a third-party cynic who could really be no one other than me. Energy field. Those are two words that, when put together, will fire off cynics' antennae very, very quickly. "Yes, now those are people who are very much in their mind, so they are not even willing to try out something new." I mentioned that my efforts to stay in the now had been frustrating, adding another layer of guilt on top of the normal churn of my mind. "Because I'm thinking all the time," I said, "I can't be in touch with the now, so now I'm feeling guilty about not being in touch with the now." "Yes, as you rightly put it, that's another layer of thinking, and that layer of thinking says, 'You see, it doesn't work, I can't be free of thinking,' which is more thinking," he said, laughing gently. "So how do you break out of that?" "You simply observe that it's another thought, and by knowing that it's another thought, you're not totally identified with the thought." This made my head hurt. Clearly, this line of questioning was going nowhere. Keenly aware that Tolley's assistant Anthony had his eye on the clock, I decided to move on, which is when we came to the part of the interview where Tolley made what I considered to be his most ludicrous claim yet. "Don't you ever get pissed off, annoyed, irritated, sad, anything negative?" "No, I accept what is, and that's why life has become so simple." "Well, what if somebody cuts you off in your car?" "It's fine. It's like a sudden gust of wind. I don't personalize a gust of wind, and so it's simply what is." "And you're able to enjoy every moment, even if I start asking you a ton of annoying questions?" "Yes, that would be fine. Don't tempt me." Here he let out a real laugh from the diaphragm, leaning forward in his chair, eyes almost closed. He recovered and picked right up. "It's becoming friendly just with the isness of this moment." The isness of this moment? Who is this guy kidding? Was he really saying that he was never in a bad mood, that nothing ever bothered him? How could he sit there on camera and claim that? It sounded great, of course, but so did learning how to fly. I don't fully understand that because I sometimes think about change, either innovation or social activism, like that little bit of sand in an oyster that creates a pearl. Yes, well, is it a clam or an oyster? I can't remember. Anyway, you know what I'm talking about. Laughing again, he continued, "The most powerful change comes actually out of that different state of consciousness, This is why people so admire what Gandhi did, because he was bringing about change from a state of consciousness that was already at peace. And people sometimes believe that if you're already at peace, you're never going to do anything. But that's not the case. Very powerful actions come out of that. So you're not saying sit around, let everything wash over you, let people cut you off in your car. You're saying understand that it is what it is right now, and then do what you need to do, he said, interrupting me this time and speaking with uncharacteristic brio. Make the present moment your friend rather than your enemy, because many people live habitually as if the present moment were an obstacle that they need to overcome in order to get to the next moment. And imagine living your whole life like that, where always this moment is never quite right, not good enough, because you need to get to the next one. That is continuous stress. Okay, now this made a ton of sense to me. For example, in the case of inauguration coverage, I could have accepted that my exclusion was already a reality and then simply had a series of calm conversations with my bosses about whether it was possible to change things instead of firing off a spray of foot bullets. Sitting with Tolle was like watching the movie version of his books. Both in person and on the page, he moved with total ease between tremendously useful insights and head-scratching, grandiose claims about perfect imperturbability. By this point, the interview had run long. Felicia was visibly anxious. She apologetically explained to Tolle and Anthony that we really needed a walking shot, a picture of me and Tolle walking down the street or something. Everyone agreed this request could be accommodated. We took the elevator down to the lobby, where I chatted with Tolle while Felicia and the crew went outside to find a suitable spot for the shot. Sometimes after an interview, people are warmer. They're relieved it's over, and they feel they've gotten to know the interviewer a bit. Tolle's affect, however, was utterly unchanged. He exuded the same pleasant unflappability. Making small talk, I asked him his age, and he told me he was 62. When I remarked that he looked much younger than that, he told me matter-of-factly that he basically hadn't aged since he'd had his spiritual awakening, which happened when he was 29. Yet another sharp left turn into Crazy Town. The story aired a few weeks later on both Sunday World News and Nightline. The reactions from my colleagues were interesting. A few of them wrote Tolle off as a whack job. Several others said they found him oddly compelling. My friend Jean Marie, for example, described him as being like a Yule log, initially boring, but ultimately mesmerizing. Personally, the encounter had left me in a funny spot. I definitely didn't think Tolle was a fraud. I'd interviewed hucksters, prosperity preachers, child slave dealers, Saddam Hussein flunkies who vowed to turn back the U.S.-led invasion, but this guy didn't give off the I'm full of shit and I know it vibe at all. Maybe he was simply deluded, impossible for me to tell. Essentially, I was right back where I was the first time I peered into the pages of his strange little book, fascinated yet frustrated. Tolle had opened something up for me, a window into the enfeebling clamor of the ego, but he had not answered my most pressing questions. How do you tame the voice in your head? How do you stay in the now? Was it really possible to defeat the gray Stalinism of self-absorption without ending up on a park bench? I was not about to let this drop. It was as if I'd met a man who told me my hair was on fire and then refused to offer me a fire extinguisher. Chapter 4. Happiness, Inc. The first thing you notice is the rhinestone glasses, then the fragrance, like he's just stepped out of a 2-hour massage. I met Deepak Chopra 6 weeks after my interview with Eckhart Tolle. While I had thought of little else other than the ego and its discontents during those weeks, my encounter with Chopra, another self-help superstar, was entirely unplanned. I called it serendipity. Chopra almost certainly would have called it karma. I had been asked to fly to Seattle to moderate a Nightline debate, or face-off in the preferred rebranding of the show's executive producer, with the extremely subtle title, Does Satan Exist? Chopra, who was always, as we say in the business, TV-friendly, had been booked to argue the no case, alongside a Pentecostal bishop who'd lost most of his congregation after publicly reconsidering the existence of the devil. The yes side was made up of a hip young local pastor, as well as a former prostitute who ran an evangelical group called Hookers for Jesus. I was only vaguely familiar with Chopra. I knew, of course, that he was probably the most famous guru on earth and that he'd written truckloads of best-selling books. I'd seen his cameo in the movie The Love Guru. He struck me as the Golden Arches or Nike swoosh of spirituality, a globally recognized icon next to whom celebrities could pose when they wanted to signal depth. I was also aware that while he preached good vibes and serenity, Chopra enjoyed wading into controversies over politics, science, and faith, sometimes even going on Fox News to mix it up with conservative hosts like Sean Hannity. It was that combination of spiritual star power and zeal for rhetorical combat that had motivated my producers to book Chopra for this face-off, which we were filming in a church in downtown Seattle. The house was packed with 1,000 people, all invited by the four debaters. The plan was to have the participants go at it for 2 hours while we recorded with a battery of cameras strategically located throughout the room. We would then cut it down to the juiciest moments and air it as a full half-hour broadcast of Nightline several weeks later. Before the main event, the producers asked me to tape pre-interviews with the combatants, goading them into talking smack like boxers before they go into the ring. After chatting with the ex-hooker and the two pastors, my crew and I found Deepak in one of the church's back rooms. In addition to blinged-out glasses, he wore jeans, bright red sneakers, and a blazer the likes of which I had never seen, charcoal gray, knee-length with an elaborate mandarin collar. He had a fleshy face, pleasant latte-colored skin, and a soft chocolate baritone with just enough of an Indian accent to sound exotic. In the interview, he exuded bravado as befitted an event such as this. He dismissed Satan as a construct of people who needed an irrational mythical explanation for evil in the world. As for his debate performance, he vowed, "I'm not going to do anything to offend anyone, but I still have to speak my own truth." Clearly, Chopra was with the program, the one envisioned by Nightline, but he also presented an irresistible opportunity for me to pursue my own agenda. I wanted to get his take on Eckhart Tolle, so I told him my story, that I had been intrigued by Tolle's description of the ego, but bemused by his lack of actionable advice. Right off the bat, Chopra dismissed Tolle as not a very good writer. Apparently self-help gurus talk smack about one another just as some evangelicals do, I realized. Then when I asked him if he knew how to stay in the moment, he allowed that he did. In fact, he insisted that he was permanently present. Our bosses had been encouraging the on-air types to produce more content for ABCNews.com. I thought talking to Deepak about the notion of the now might make a good little video, so I whipped out a flip camera and popped a few more questions. "So your mind doesn't wander," I asked. "You don't find yourself thinking about things that are in the past or in the future?" "I have no regrets about the past," he said, "and I don't anticipate the future. I live in the moment." "Okay, so what if the moment is horrible? What if you really have to go to the bathroom and there's no toilet nearby? Or what if you're super hungry and there's no food?" "Then I separate myself from the situation surrounding the moment. The moment is always free." "Run that by me again," I said. "It's a sort of mind trick?" "It's not a mind trick. When you're totally present, whatever the situation is, good or bad, it's going to pass. The only thing that remains is the moment. It's the transformational vortex to the infinite." Apparently, when one lives in the moment, one becomes unafraid of using terms like transformational vortex to the infinite. He still wasn't giving me specifics, so I pushed again. "How do you do that? Because while I'm talking to you right now, sometimes my mind wanders and I think, wow, those are nice glasses, or what am I going to ask next?" "If you stay in the moment, you'll have what is called spontaneous right action, which is intuitive, which is creative, which is visionary, which eavesdrops on the mind of the universe." I had no idea what he was talking about, but we were out of time. The sound tech arrived and began wiring Chopra with his lapel microphone for the debate. "I still think you make it sound easier than it is," I said. He looked at me and gave a good-natured shrug that seemed to say, "What can I say, you unlucky schmuck?" "For me, it is," he said. "How do I become more like you?" "Hang around with me," he said. And then, moving in closer as the sound guy struggled to keep up, he asked for my mailing address, which I somewhat reluctantly gave him. After all that fancy talk of living in the moment and eavesdropping on the mind of the universe, as soon as we hit the stage and got into the heat of the debate, Chopra was raising his voice, gesticulating wildly, and arguing in a way that certainly did not signal serenity. When he didn't have the floor, he would slouch back in his chair, feet stretched out in front of him, looking entirely nonplussed. To me, at least, he didn't seem to be present at all, certainly not in the Eckhart Tolle blissed-out way. But maybe he was. What do I know? Maybe, I thought to myself, I shouldn't reach reflexive conclusions as I did with Ted Haggard. Perhaps Deepak Chopra represented the twinning of passionate striving and ego subjugation. Is it possible this guy had it all figured out? I wasn't optimistic. But I was surprised by the reaction when I posted my Chopra video on the ABC News website. First, it generated so much traffic that it landed in the most viewed column. Then I got an email from the last person I expected, my boss. David Westin, the president of the news division, was not the type of man I thought likely to be searching for a transformational vortex to the infinite. Formerly a corporate lawyer, he'd run the news division for more than a decade. He was sharply handsome with boyish Midwestern features and a full head of slightly blonde hair that seemed to stay firmly in place without any discernible application of product. He favored Brooks Brothers suits, striped ties and loafers, and his personal style was commensurately crisp, earnest, and affable. He easily could have been a politician or an anchorman. Weston's email said he was curious on a personal level about my conversation with Chopra. He suggested we meet to discuss. His assistant set an appointment, and a few days later I found myself walking up one flight of stairs from my office to the executive suite, referred to simply by its geographic designation, the fifth floor. The air was different up here, as if it were pumped in from the Sierra Nevada. It was a wide-open room with offices lining the periphery and assistants stationed outside of each. The heavy hush was devoid of the clack and clamor that characterized the rest of the news division. In the middle of the space was a kitchen island perennially stocked with snacks and free-flowing Starbucks. Weston's secretary ushered me in, and the man himself got up from his neatly organized desk to give me a firm handshake and a courtly, enthusiastic, "Hi, Dan." After a bit of small talk, he brought up Chopra. In his diplomatic way, he said he was surprised to see me taking the guy so seriously. "I respect your opinion on these things, Dan, and Deepak is somebody I've only ever seen on daytime television. Is there really something to him?" As he spoke, I began to suspect that there must be more to my boss's interest than he was letting on. Here was a man with a supremely stressful job, managing both the outsized personalities within the news division and the demands of his corporate overlords. Once over lunch, he'd admitted to me that his real personality was, at times, significantly less sunny than his persona. "There is something there," I said, "although I'm not sure Chopra is the best example of it." Then I launched into an unsuccessful and overly emphatic soliloquy about Eckhart Tolle, the ego, the present moment, and God knows what else. The longer I yammered on about the thinking mind and the voice in the head, the more I realized that I wasn't making much sense. This was the first opportunity I'd had to discuss this material with anyone, aside from actually interviewing Tolle and Chopra themselves, and it suddenly hit me that I didn't really know what I was talking about, which made me even more anxious and, by turns, even more talkative. Finally, seeing I'd lost my audience, I swallowed the flood of saliva in my mouth and concluded by saying that maybe Weston should just read Tolle's book. The next day, I slinked back upstairs and dropped it off with his secretary, all the while thinking, this is what it's come to. I'm the crazy guy handing out religious tracts on the street. I still wanted to talk about this stuff, though, to people I liked and trusted. It wasn't that I felt compelled to convert anyone. I just wanted a sounding board. Figuring that this would be easier with someone who wasn't my boss, I broached the subject at a dinner with my friend Regina. For a decade, Regina and I had been having no-holds-barred debates about everything from TV shows to New York real estate to my sometimes questionable pre-Bianca romantic decisions. I figured the machinery of the ego would be terrific fodder. Moments after I started blathering about Eckhart Tolle, however, Regina cut me off. "Whatever, Dan, if you need this, fine." Then she changed the subject to which soups we should order. The verdict was rendered with such offhand ferocity that it made me realize that this topic I thought so alive with potential could come off as merely fuzzy and embarrassing. She wasn't engaged enough to even needle me about it. My losing streak continued at a family brunch when I floated Tolle past my younger brother. I should have seen this one coming. Matt's mission in life since emerging from the womb had been to torment me. Even though he was now a venture capitalist and the father of a beautiful baby girl, his devotion to puncturing my balloon had not diminished. As soon as I finished my spiel, he just stared back at me with a satisfied smirk, the knife inserted with nary a word. Not long afterward, he gave me an Eckhart Tolle calendar for Christmas. I unwrapped it, looked up, and saw him on the other side of the room wearing the same smirk. What made this series of failures especially frustrating was the realization that the expressions on the faces of my interlocutors were probably not dissimilar to the way I must have looked when confronted with some of the fringier religious people I'd interviewed over the years. Even with people who weren't reflexively hostile to the material, I wasn't making terrific inroads. At a group dinner downtown, I cornered my friend Kayama, an open-minded professor of French lit at Columbia. As I concluded my discourse on the now, she asked, "But how do you really stay in the moment when it's always slipping away?" I had no answer. Perhaps the most meaningful exchange I had on the subject was a completely random discussion with my Uncle Martin at my parents' annual summer pool party. Martin, a former entrepreneur who was now in the early stages of Alzheimer's, turned to me and asked an intriguing question. "Which is more exciting to you, reality or memory?" I paused, considered it, and said, "I wish I could say reality, but it's probably memory." And then I asked, "What about you?" At which point Martin stared blankly back at me and asked, "What was the question?" Bianca was mildly receptive to my newfound area of interest. Mostly she was intrigued by the notion of having a less stressed husband-to-be. Then again, I had just come through a year-long obsession with climate change. It was reasonable to assume that this was just another of my transient fixations, only kookier. I was stuck in the same place I'd found myself at the end of my Tolle interview, knowing my hair was on fire but lacking an extinguisher. With Tolle having failed to answer my questions and struggling with an ongoing inability to explain what intrigued me about all of this in even the most basic comprehensible terms, I was at my wit's end. I didn't know where to turn. I recalled what Chopra had said to me at the end of our interview, "Hang around with me." Just days after I'd met him, he'd sent a whole stack of his books to my office with titles like The Book of Secrets and Reinventing the Body, Resurrecting the Soul. He'd been texting and emailing me and even forwarding me a Google alert he'd set on himself in which Kim Kardashian sang his praises. Warily, I figured, what do I have to lose? Deepak was wearing a t-shirt emblazoned with a peace sign made out of sequins as he enthusiastically showed me around the Manhattan outpost of the Chopra Center. Located in a she-she midtown hotel, the center offered spa treatments, medical consults, yoga, and astrological readings. We were in the gift shop. As I let my eyes fall on his vast array of personally branded products, Ayurvedic cold and allergy remedies, antioxidant supplements, harmonizing necklaces, shirts printed with the word abundance, and books, 55 or 56 of them, he couldn't remember exactly, on everything from God to golf to cooking, I was thinking about Jay-Z, who once rapped, "I'm not a businessman, I'm a business man." Felicia and I had decided to profile Deepak for Sunday World News. It didn't take a lot of convincing to get him on board, and it became readily apparent how this man had landed on the Forbes list of richest celebrities with an estimated income of $22 million a year. His itinerary was a manic, many-splendored thing. In just a few days, I personally saw him host a satellite radio show, hold meetings with video game developers for a project based on his spiritual teachings, and discuss a Broadway show with a man who claimed he could bend spoons with the power of his mind. On many levels, Deepak seemed like a walking contradiction. He claimed to be perennially present, and yet we filmed him pounding down the street while furiously typing on his BlackBerry, and then voraciously devouring articles on his Kindle while ostensibly working out on an elliptical machine. He claimed to live in a state of flow and effortless spontaneity, but he seemed pretty focused on mundane self-promotion to me. While publicizing his latest book, he lobbied a reporter to follow him on Twitter, and when shooting a promotional video, he told the cameraman, "Make sure I don't look fat." These didn't strike me as the actions of a man living in perfect harmony with himself. This was the type of shit I did. We did an interview at a picnic table in Central Park, and I challenged his self-proclaimed imperturbability. Thinking back to his performance at the face-off, I said, "Sometimes I've seen you worked up." "But even though I was worked up," he responded, "did you find that there was anger, resentment, or hostility in that? I can't read your mind, but judging from your body language, you weren't pleased." "Without passion, you'd be a walking dead person," he said. "Even though you're dynamically engaged, you're not stressed." Was it really just dynamic engagement and not stress? Deepak insisted that, in fact, he hadn't experienced stress in decades. He told me that years ago, when he was a frazzled young medical resident in suburban Massachusetts, he smoked 2 packs of cigarettes a day and drank too much. "We used to take care of a cardiac arrest and then we'd go outside and smoke a cigarette," he said. But then, quite suddenly, he changed everything. "It was dramatic," he told me. "I finally one day made a decision that that part of my life was over. I said, I've been there, done that." He quit his day job and went to work for the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, the bearded Indian holy man, perhaps most famous for his stint as the official guru of the Beatles. After a brief stay at his ashram, John Lennon left in a huff over allegations that the Maharishi had tried to fondle Mia Farrow. On his way back to London, Lennon wrote the song Sexy Sadie, featuring the lyric, "What have you done? You've made a fool of everyone." Deepak climbed to the rank of the Maharishi's top lieutenant, but he and the Maharishi grew apart. Deepak started feeling like the group had become too cultish, and the Maharishi thought Deepak too ambitious, so Deepak left. Unleashed from hierarchical constraint, Deepak spread his wings. He'd become intrigued by spontaneous remissions, those dramatic and inexplicable recoveries where people bounce back from serious illnesses. When he couldn't get any reputable medical journals to publish his research, he paid a vanity press $5,000 to put it out as a book. It was a hit. Scores more followed. He became friends with Michael Jackson, who introduced him to Oprah, who put him on television. The rest was history. By the time I met Deepak, he was 63 years old. He'd recorded an album of freaky new age music with Martin Sheen, Madonna, and Demi Moore. Lady Gaga had called him the most influential person in her life. Time had dubbed him the poet prophet of alternative medicine. He had fierce critics, though. The publisher of Skeptic magazine put Deepak on the cover, lampooning his medical conclusions as mostly wild speculations based on only the slimmest of evidence. So, was he full of shit? I couldn't tell. As with Tolly, I found him to be a baffling mixtape of the interesting and the incomprehensible, like a DJ toggling between the Rolling Stones and Rick Astley, the band, and Dokken. I liked it when he said things like, "The fact that you exist is a highly statistically improbable event, and if you are not perpetually surprised by the fact that you exist, you don't deserve to be here." But too often he reverted to a seemingly involuntary, impenetrable spiritual patois that had a certain je ne sais pas pourquoi. His memorable assertions to me included, "The universe is a nanotechnology workshop in the mind of God," and "Don't call it God, call it acausal, non-local, quantum mechanical interreligiousness." Chopra was infinitely more fun to hang out with than Tolly. I preferred Deepak's rascally "What Makes Sammy Run" style to the German's otherworldly diffidence. But I left the experience more confused, not less. Eckhart was befuddling because, while I believed he was sincere, I couldn't tell if he was sane. With Deepak, it was the opposite. I believed he was sane, but I couldn't tell if he was sincere. It was intriguing that someone could strive so nakedly and yet claim to be without stress. That would have answered many of my questions about defeating the ego without killing your edge, if only I believed him. My next move was motivated by sheer desperation. It was mercifully brief, but unrelentingly absurd. Felicia and I decided to launch a whole series of stories on self-help for Sunday World News. We called it Happiness Inc. The idea was to delve into an unregulated $11 billion industry that had attracted a growing number of followers as Americans moved away from organized religion. With no answers forthcoming from Tolly or Chopra, this was the only thing I could think to do. What I found in this distinctly American subculture was beyond crazy. A parade of the unctuous and the unqualified, preaching to the desperate and often destitute. One of the leading players in this questionable game was Joe Vitale, who had risen to prominence after landing a cameo in what would become a monster cultural phenomenon called The Secret. This was a high-gloss book and DVD that came out in 2006 and featured a whole crew of self-help gurus expounding on the law of attraction, which offered the prospect of getting anything you wanted, health, wealth, love, simply by thinking about it in the right way. It was essentially a slick repackaging of an old idea that had been sent up the flagpole by such pioneering turkeys as Napoleon Hill, who produced the 1930s bestseller Think and Grow Rich, and Norman Vincent Peale, author of the canonical turd The Power of Positive Thinking. As I slid into the backseat of Vitale's Rolls Royce, it truly hit home to me how far Deepak was on the benign end of the self-help spectrum. Vitale had a doughy face and a large, hairless head, which gave the impression of a vastly overgrown baby. He was giving my crew and me a free taste of what would normally cost $5,000, something he called the Rolls-Royce Phantom Mastermind Session. As his driver squired us through the Texas countryside, Vitale explained that people paid to come to his home in exurban Austin and take a ride with him, during which he helped them mastermind ideas that change lives. With the camera pointing back at us from the front seat, I said, "This is an amazing car, but $5,000 is a lot for 3 hours with you." "Well, there are people who think I should charge a lot more than that. They think that's giving it away." The Rolls was just one of many sources of income for Dr. Vitale. Homeless just 30 years ago, Vitale had earned his PhD in metaphysics through a correspondence course from the University of Sedona. He now lived in a large house with many cars purchased with the proceeds from dozens of books with titles like Expect Miracles and Attract Money Now. He also sold products like margarita mix, a health drink called Youth Juice, and stickers with pictures of Russian dolls on them that, for reasons I couldn't quite understand, Vitale insisted would help the owner meet his or her life goals. List price, $39. In an interview in Vitale's home office, I asked, "You never wake up in the middle of the night thinking, I can't believe I'm getting away with this?" "No, never," he said, laughing as if this were the last thing that would have ever occurred to him. While, in theory, I could see the appeal of positive thinking, especially as a man who unquestionably spent too much time ruminating, when I scratched the surface of this philosophy, I quickly encountered gale force inanity. On the DVD version of The Secret, Vitale pops up on screen to utter such memorable chestnuts as, "You are the Michelangelo of your own life. The David that you are sculpting is you, and you do it with your own thoughts." Under questioning in our interview, though, Vitale admitted that it was not that easy. In fact, he folded like a cheap lawn chair. "So what if I want a diamond necklace for my wife?" I asked. "Can I get that by thinking about it?" "Not just by thinking about it. That's one of the biggest misconceptions of all time. You have to take action. It's not just thinking. It's thinking coupled with action." "Isn't that a statement of the glaringly obvious? You think it's news to most people that if you want something, you have to try to get it?" "You know, when you put it that way, it sounds silly," he said, laughing sheepishly. "Pretty brainless." The more worrisome message of The Secret phenomenon was not the preposterousness of its primary sales pitch, but instead its destructive undercurrent. The inverse of your logic, I argued to Vitale, seems to blame the victim, because if you aren't getting what you want, it must be your fault. "This is not a blame game," he insisted. "Our unconscious thoughts are what's creating our reality, and many of our unconscious thoughts are not very positive. They're negative. They actually attract problems." "So would this be true of kids with cancer? Victims of genocide?" "It strains credulity," I said, "to say that everybody who got hit by the earthquake in Haiti had some unconscious thinking going on that led to them being victims." "None of those people are being victimized. In other words," here I interrupted him, "in an earthquake, you're victimized, aren't you?" An awkward pause, a stutter, and then he conceded, "In an earthquake, you're victimized." The other star of The Secret I covered managed to push the absurdity level directly into the truly dangerous range. James Arthur Ray was a fit, 50-something, divorced junior college dropout who oozed smarmy overconfidence, an oily character.